We are in the book of Genesis, chapter 49. We've just finished up the prophetic address of Israel, Jacob, to his 12 boys, plus two of his grandsons that have become his adopted sons. And he has, through the power of the Holy Spirit, said something about each of these tribes of significance. Might have had something to do with why they're not in the inheritance structure where they should have been, or perhaps where they're going to be located as a tribal group in the future, or what sort of character their tribe is going to be represented by in the future. And so we tried to talk about all of that as we were going through these 12 men's names. But after Israel has finished passing this prophetic information along, he then issues his final instructions before he lapses into unconsciousness and then shortly after that dies. And the instructions are regarding the place of his body. And this is what he says. Verse 29, "Then he commanded them and said to them, 'I am to be gathered to my people.'" And we talked about how that's kind of a double meaning phrase. To be gathered spiritually is to go into the presence of those righteous members of his family of the past. He's going to be with Abraham and Isaac in the waiting place during the Old Testament period, in the place of peace that eventually takes on the term the bosom of Abraham. So he's going to be gathered to his people in that sense, but he's also going to have his body gathered to his people with his people gathered around him, being interred in the cave of Machpelah. So he says, "I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field at Machpelah, to the east of Mamre," which is the most ancient name for Hebron, "in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place." And you remember that story from much earlier in the book of Genesis. When Sarah died, Abraham immediately secured this cave of Machpelah to the east of the city, well, what will be the city of Hebron. He bought the field which provided access to this cave from one of the locals. And so he buried Sarah there, and from that moment on, this became the family tomb for those that were key members of this particular family. So verse 31, "There they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife." So they were the first couple in the tomb. "There they buried Yitzhak and Rebekah, his wife." So they were the second couple placed in the tomb. And then Jacob says this, "And there I buried Leah." Now we don't know when Leah died. Apparently, it would seem from the text here that she had died before Joseph sent for them to be moved to Egypt. And so now he says, "That's where I buried my wife, Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were bought from the Hittites." And when Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. So he gives the instructions. I want to be buried with Leah and my mom and dad and my grandpa and grandma in the cave of Machpelah. Now, some of you will be prompted to ask the question, why didn't he want to be buried with his beloved Rachel? And I think the obvious answer is because Rachel's not buried with mom and dad and grandpa and grandma. And then the next natural question is, well, why not? Why wasn't she buried there? And we don't know the answer. We suspected when we were going through the story this last time that it may have been just such a hot time of the year when they were making their trip that Jacob didn't feel comfortable burying Rachel a few days later at the cave of Machpelah. And so he just buried her where she was at, north of Jerusalem, near what is now the city of Ramallah. Why didn't he move her later? I don't know. All I know is that Leah was the wife buried at the cave of Machpelah, and that Jacob chose to be buried next to her, probably because the rest of his family is there as well. And it's interesting that we have the cave of Machpelah very clearly identified, thanks to Herod the Great. Herod the Great's grandfather apparently converted to Judaism. And so Herod was born and raised as a Jewish person. And he identified with the Jewish histories. They were his histories. And so when he became a very powerful king and he was starting to build all sorts of magnificent structures, which is the reason he gets the nickname The Great, because he was such a great builder, he paid a lot of money to have a grand enclosure put around the cave of Machpelah, and make it a place that could be secured from trouble in the future and where Jewish people could keep coming to pay their respects to the progenitors of their particular families. So we know exactly where it's at, and unfortunately, it is under Palestinian control at the moment, and it is tough enough for Israelis to get there and visit in peace. Christians have an even tougher time, I think, getting there and doing any type of paying of their respects, because I would love myself to go there and pay my respects at the tombs of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. But it's just too much trouble to do it on a trip to Israel. And so pray. Pray for peace in the Middle East. And definitely pray that the holy sites, such as the Cave of Machpelah, will be respected for the historical tie-ins that they are to the stories of sacred scripture. All right, so back to our story. Jacob now gets back fully into bed. He's apparently been sitting up when he was giving all of this address. And at some time shortly after that, he lapses into unconsciousness, quits drinking and eating, and we all know what it's like to be in a death watch situation. Where someone, because of their great age or because of debilitating disease, we know they're going to die soon. And so we gather around their bed. We talk to them as much as we can until they lapse into unconsciousness. And then we just pray and encourage each other and cry and share good stories until finally they pass. And then, after we've had another good cry, we do what we can to prepare for a fitting tribute to them, a celebration of life, as we like to call funerals nowadays. And that's what Joseph does. He cries first, and then he prepares to pay tribute. Chapter number 50 says, Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. I have seen that happen many, many times in a death watch situation where the relatives are there when the person takes that last breath and they immediately begin crying and kissing the face and caressing them and kind of saying their goodbyes. And then they go out and get ready to pay the tribute. For Joseph, he's got the wherewithal to make this a big deal. So Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for it, for that is how many are required for embalming. We're actually going to see that it's not just a simple 40-day process. There's more to it than that. The Egyptians wept for him 70 days, so total of 70 days. And if you check some of the informational sites that talk about Egyptian embalming practices from this time, the number 70 gets used. So Joseph gives his father the royal Egyptian treatment. Not everyone gets turned into a mummy in Egypt. Only those who have great honor in the community, like the pharaoh and like his vizier and like some of the members of the families of the rulers underneath Pharaoh. And so because Joseph is the number two in Egypt, his father is treated like a VIP. So they would have removed his brain through a procedure and his internal organs, except for his heart. They always leave the heart in place. These would have been put in special jars and kept near him. The body would have been washed. The body would have been packed in natron, which is a type of salt, for a good long period of time, which dries the body out, preserving it. Then they would have done some more washing, and then starts the wrapping process. Eventually, you've got a body that is as closely, perfectly preserved as you can do at that time, very lifelike. But it's all wrapped up, and they've also been working on a sarcophagus, a coffin, but not just a straight-up coffin. It's got the carvings of the person's face and representations of his high society connections. This is part of the honoring. And it would be so enlightening. I know it's not likely to happen, but it would be so enlightening if we could be allowed to see pictures of the inside of Jacob's coffin at Hebron, at the cave of Machpelah. Because what we would see inside of that great big box would be the sarcophagus of a high-placed Egyptian official, and inside a very carefully preserved Jewish mummy. And wouldn't that be very interesting? But a lot of people would be harmed or hurt by the idea of doing any type of scientific or tourist sort of things with their ancestor Jacob. So that's all left alone. Same thing would be true, by the way, of Joseph's body, which is buried up at Shechem, also in Palestinian territory, and therefore awfully hard to access. So the Egyptians end up spending 70 days weeping over the loss of Joseph's father, because Joseph is the hero of the Israeli people, or of the Egyptian people. And so what he cries about, they cry about. What he cares about, they care about. So this is like a very big state funeral as far as they're concerned. Verse number 4. When the days of weeping for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying... And so now this is, I think, might be another new Pharaoh, because it's been about 17 years. It's possible we had another new Pharaoh, but I can't remember the chronology off the top of my head. But he goes into the Pharaoh and talks to him about what he'd like to do next. If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak to the ears of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, I am to die in my tomb that I have hewn out for myself in the land of Canaan. There shall you bury me. So Joseph makes the request through channels to the Pharaoh. May I have your permission to leave the country and take my father back to his family plot and bury him there. Now, therefore, let me please go up and bury my father, and then I will return. And Pharaoh answered and said, go up, bury your father as he made you swear. So Pharaoh says, this is a family thing. This is an important family thing. Of course, you go up there and do what you need to do for your dad. So Joseph went up to bury his father. Remember, it's about a two-week trip. With him went up all the servants of Pharaoh. So, as I said, this is like a state funeral. And so all the bigwigs of the kingdom go up with him. The elders of his household, so that would be all of his brothers and his nephews, that are in leadership positions. They go with him. All the elders of the land of Egypt. So it's not just simply the bigwigs, it's also family heads. They want to go up, as well as all the household of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's household. And so we've got everybody that's connected with the family that's not too young and not too old. So that would include the people who have worked for the families of Joseph and his brothers all these years. They all want to go. So we have got a ton of people, hundreds upon hundreds, perhaps well over 1,000, maybe over 2,000 people that are going up in this entourage for 2 weeks from just south of the Nile Delta to Hebron. So only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. So they leave their animals, because there's no reason to take them with them. And they leave their youngest kids. And we're talking about probably grandkids for most of Joseph's family, and even for himself. There went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. So we've also got a military escort, an honor escort that goes with them. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which we don't know exactly where this is, but we can surmise where it is based on the travel route. The travel route would have gone this way. It would have gone from the land of Goshen along the eastern side of the delta up to the coast of the Mediterranean and up to where Gaza is today, thereabouts, then it would have cut across to Beersheba and then from there up to Hebron. Now, the reason why I'm going over this in detail is because some people have made a huge mistake in reading the book of Genesis at this point and put the route over on the east side of the Dead Sea for some reason. And this is why. It says, when they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan. Now remember who's writing this. Moses is writing this. Where is he at? He is on the east side of the Jordan River. He's never allowed to cross the Jordan River into Canaan proper. That was part of a penalty for not doing things appropriately. So when he refers to beyond the river, he's talking about the west side of the Jordan River, Canaan proper. So the threshing floor of Atad is in Canaan proper. And my suspicion is that it's just slightly south and west of Mamre. Because they wanted to probably stop right before they got to the city of Mamre or the community of Mamre and still be within an easy walk to the cave of Machpelah. And so there they lamented with a very great and grievous lamentation. So they set up their encampment and they begin to cry and play sad music. It is the beginning of the funeral. And for them, funerals last more than a few hours. They last days. It says here, he, meaning Joseph, made a mourning for his father 7 days. So this goes on probably 24/7 for 7 days. Maybe during the hours of darkness, it's a little bit quieter, a little bit more soft, but they are trying to make it clear to anybody within earshot, we are grieving over the death of a great man. And that is why verse 11 says, when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning on the threshing floor of Atad. Remember, a threshing floor is going to be a flat area up on the top of a hill because that's where you start using the wind power to separate the grain from the chaff. So you first run your threshing sledges over it, and then you get that piled up and start using the wind to separate what you're keeping from what you're not keeping. So it's probably not in use right now. My guess is it's not grain processing time, or they wouldn't have set their encampment up here. It would have been in use. So they set up in this big open area, and the Canaanites, not just simply from Mamre, but all over the place, are impressed with what's going on in their community. And no doubt, they were told that this is the man that used to live with them, the man that used to run sheep right around here. So he's a big name in Egypt as well as in Canaan. And they said, this is the grievous mourning by the Egyptians. And therefore the place was named Avel Mitzrayim. Abel has the idea of a flat area, a meadow, a grassy place, or maybe it's also another word for mourning. That's the suggestion. But Mitzrayim is the ancient name for Egypt. So it's the meadow of Egyptian mourning. And then we're told again by Moses, it is beyond the Jordan, which means west of the Jordan, near Hebron. And thus his sons did for him as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field at Machpelah, to the east of Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. And so, after that, after he'd buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. So all of this happened in 1869, possibly 1868 BC. And after the funeral, and those of you that have done this, you know, one of the hardest things is to leave the graveyard. But you have to. You have to get on with your life. And so after they say their goodbyes, Joseph and his brothers all head back to Egypt to resume their lives there, because that is where they will all live out the rest of their lives, because that is God's plan. That's God's intention. But when they get back to Egypt, we're going to have some recriminations that have to be dealt with. And that is what we'll talk about the next time we get into God's Word.